The showers in the watch house were the talk of the city. Vimes had paid for them himself, after Vetinari made an acidic comment about the cost. They were a bit primitive, and were really no more than watering can heads connected to a couple of water tanks on the next floor, but after a night in Ankh Morpork's underworld, the thought of being really clean was very attractive. Even so, Angua hesitated. "But this is wonderful," said Sally, turning gently under a spray. "What's wrong?" "Look, I'm dealing with it, all right," snapped Angua, standing just beyond the shower. "It's full moon, okay? The wolf is a bit strong." Sally stopped scrubbing. "Oh, I see," she said. "Is it the whole B-A-T-H thing?" "You just had to say that, didn't you?" said Angua, and forced herself to step onto the tiles. "Well, what do you do normally?" said Sally, handing her the soap. "Cold water and pretend it's rain. Don't you dare laugh. Change the subject right now."
"All right."
"What did you think of Nobby's girlfriend?" said Sally.
"Tawny, friendly, good-looking.
Try perfect physical beauty, astonishing proportions, a walking classic."
"Well, yes, pretty much," Angua conceded.
"And all that is Nobby Nobbs's girlfriend?"
"She seems to think so."
"You're not telling me she deserves Nobby," said Sally.
"Look, Verity Pushpram doesn't deserve Nobby, and she's got a weird squint, arms like a stevedore, and cooks shellfish for a living," said Angua. "That's how things are."
"Is she his old girlfriend?"
"He used to say so. As far as I know, the physical side of the relationship consists of her hitting him with a wet fish whenever he goes near her." Angua squeezed the last of the slime out of her hair. It was tough stuff to lose. As it was, some of it was fighting not to go down the plug hole. That was enough. She didn't like to spend too much time in the S-H-O-W-E-R. Another six or so sessions, and the smell would have quite gone away. The important thing now was to remember to use a towel and not shake herself dry.
"You think I went down there to impress Captain Carrot, don't you?" said Sally behind her.
Angua stopped, her head wrapped in toweling. Oh, well, it was going to happen sooner or later.
"No," she said.
"Your heartbeat says otherwise," Sally said meekly. "Don't worry, I wouldn't have a chance. His heart beats faster every time he looks at you, and yours skips a beat every time you see him."
"Okay, then, this is it," said the wolf, who was never far away. "This is where we sort it out, claw against fang."
"No!
Don't listen to the wolf."
"But it would help, wouldn't it, if this stupid bitch stopped listening to the bat?"
"Stay out of people's hearts," she growled.
"I can't. You can't switch off your nose, can you?"
"Can you?"
The moment of the wolf had passed. Angua relaxed a little.
"His heart beat faster, did it?"
"No," she said, "I can't."
"Has he ever seen you without your uniform?"
"Ye gods," thought Angua, and headed for her clothes.
"Well, of course," she mumbled.
"I meant wearing something else, like a dress," Sally went on.
"Come on! Every copper spends some time out of uniform. That's how you'll know you're off duty."
"But it's pretty much a 24/8 job for us," said Angua. "There's always..."
"You mean it is for him because he likes it that way, and so you go along with it," said the vampire.
And that one got through all Angua's defences.
"It's my life! Why should I listen to advice from a vampire? Because you're a werewolf," said Sally. "Only a vampire would dare to give it, right? You don't have to be at his heel all the time."
"Look, I've been through all this, understand? It's a werewolf thing. We are what we are."
"I'm not. You don't get the black ribbon just for signing the pledge, you know. And it doesn't mean you stop craving blood. You just don't do anything about it. At least you can go out at night and chase chickens."
There was a stony silence. Then Angua said,
"You know about the chickens?"
"Yes. I pay for them, you know.
I'm sure you do. And it's not as though it's every night. I'm sure it isn't.
Look, do you know there are people out there who will volunteer to be a vampire's
dinner companion, providing it's all done with style? And we are considered weird."
She sniffed.
"By the way, what did you wash your hair in?"
"Willard Brothers' Good Girl Flea Shampoo," said Angua. "It brings up the gloss," she added defensively.
"Look, I want to get this clear, right? Just because we spent hours wading around under the city and, okay, maybe saved each other's lives once or twice, it does not mean we're friends, okay? We just happened to be there at the same time."
"You do need some time off," said Sally.
"I was going to buy a drink for Tawny anyway to say thanks, and Cheery wants to tag along. How about it? We've been stood down for now. Time out for a little fun."
Angua struggled with a seething snake's nest of emotions. Tawny had been very kind, and far more helpful than you might expect from someone wearing 6 inches of heel and 4 square inches of clothing.
"Come on," said Sally encouragingly. "I don't know about you, but it's going to take a bit of effort to get the taste of that mud out of my mouth."
"Oh, all right. But this doesn't mean we're bonding."
"Fine, fine. I'm not a bondage kind of person.
Yes, yes, I can see that."
Vimes sat and stared at his notebook. He'd got "Talking Cube" written down and circled. Out of the corner of his ear he could hear the sounds of the city watch rising from below, the bustle in the yard of the old lemonade factory, where the specials were assembling again, just in case, the rattle of the hurry-up wagon, the general murmur of voices coming up through the floor. After some thinking, he wrote "Old Well" and circled that, too. He'd scrumped plums in the gardens of Empirical Crescent with all the other kids. Half the houses were empty and no one cared much. Yes, there had been a well, but it had long been full up to the top with garbage even then. Grass was growing on the top. They only found the bricks because they looked for them. So let's say that anything buried right at the bottom where the dwarfs had headed had been dumped, oh, more than 50, 60 years ago. You never saw a dwarf in Ankh-Morpork even 40 years ago, and they weren't anything like rich or powerful enough to own a cube. They were hard workers, seeking, just possibly, a better life. So what human would throw away a talking box worth a mountain of gold? He'd have to be bloody mad. Vimes sat rigidly staring at the scrawls on the page. In the distance, Detritus was barking a command at someone. He felt like a man crossing a river on stepping stones. He was nearly halfway across, but the next stone was just a bit too far and could only be reached with seriously groinal stress. Nevertheless, his foot was waving in the air, and it was that or a ducking. He wrote "rascal." Then he circled the word several times, the pencil biting into the cheap paper. Rascal must have been to Coombe Valley. Let's say he found a cube there, who knows how, just lying there. Anyway, he brings it home. He paints his picture and goes mad, but somewhere along the line the cube starts talking to him. Vimes wrote "special word." He drew a circle round it so hard that his pencil broke. Maybe he can't find the word for "stop talking." Anyway, he chucks it down a well. He tried to write "Did Rascal ever live in Empirical Crescent?" and then gave up and tried to remember it. Anyway, then he dies, and afterwards this damn book is written. It doesn't sell many copies, but recently it's republished, and but now there are lots of dwarfs in the city, that's true. There were only a few here, even when I was a kid. Some of them read it, and something tells them that the secret is in this cube. They find out where it is. How? Doesn't the book say the secret of Coombe Valley is in the painting? Okay, maybe he somehow painted some kind of code into the painting to say where the cube was. But so what? What was so bad to hear that you killed the poor devils who heard it? I think I'm looking at this wrong. It's not my cow. It's a sheep with a pitchfork. Unfortunately, it goes quack. He was getting lost now, going all over the place, but he'd got a toe on the opposite stone, and he felt he'd made some progress. But to what, exactly? I mean, what would really happen if there was proof that, say, the dwarfs ambushed the trolls? Nothing that isn't happening already, that's what. You could always find an excuse that your side would accept, and who cares what the enemy thinks? In the real world, it wouldn't make any difference. There was a faint knock at the door, the sort that you use if you secretly hope it won't be answered. Vimes sprang from his chair and pulled the door open. A.E. Pessimal stood there.
"Ah, A.E.," said Vimes, going back to his desk and laying down his pencil. "Come on in. What can I do for you? How's the arm?"
Could you spare a moment of your time, Your Grace?"
"Your Grace," thought Vimes. Well, he hadn't the heart to object this time. He sat down again. A.E. Pessimal was still wearing the chainmail shirt with the specials badge on it. He didn't look very shiny. Brick's swipe had bowled him across the plaza like a ball.
A.E. Pessimal began. "You'll have to start as a lance constable, but a man of your talents ought to make it a sergeant within the year, and you can have your own office," said Vimes.
A.E. Pessimal shut his eyes.
"How did you know?" he breathed.
"You attacked a boozed-up troll with your teeth,"
said Vimes. "There's a man born for the badge," I thought to myself. "And that's what you've always wanted, right? But you're always too small, too weak, too shy to be a watchman. I can buy big and strong anywhere. Right now I need a man who knows how to hold a pencil without breaking it." "You'll be my adjutant," said Vimes. "You'll handle all my paperwork. You'll read the reports. You'll try to figure out what's important. And so you can learn what is important, you'll have to do at least 2 patrols a week." A tear was running down A.E. Pessimal's cheek. "Thank you. Thank you, Your Grace," he said hoarsely. If A.E. Pessimal had had enough chest to stick out, it would be sticking. "Of course, you'll need to finish your report on the watch first," Vimes went on. "That is a matter between you and his lordship. And now, if you'll excuse me, I really must get on. I look forward to seeing you working for me, Lance Constable Pessimal." "Thank you, Your Grace." "Oh, and you won't call me Your Grace," said Vimes. He thought for a moment, and decided that the man had earned this, all in one go, and added, "Mr. Vimes will do." "And so we make progress," he said to himself, after A.E. Pessimal had floated away. "And his lordship won't like it. So far as I can see, there's no downside. Quis custodiet ipsos custodes? Qui custodes custodient? Was that right for who watches the watcher that watches the watchman? Probably not. Still, your move, my lord." He was just puzzling over his notebook again when the door opened without an introductory knock. Sybil entered with a plate. "You're not eating enough, Sam," she announced, "and the canteen here is a disgrace. It's all grease and stodge." "That's what the men like, I'm afraid," said Vimes guiltily. "I've cleaned out the tea urn, at least," Sybil went on with satisfaction. "You cleaned out the tea urn?" said Vimes in a hollow voice. It was like being told that someone had wiped the patina off a fine old work of art. "Yes, it was like tar in there. There really wasn't much proper food in the store, but I managed to make you a bacon, lettuce and tomato sandwich." "Thank you, dear." Vimes cautiously lifted a corner of the bread with his stricken pencil. There seemed to be too much lettuce, which is to say, there was some lettuce. "There's a lot of dwarfs come to see you, Sam," said Sybil, as if this was preying on her mind. Vimes stood up so fast that his chair fell over. "Is young Sam all right?" he said.
"Yes, Sam, they're city dwarfs. You know them all, I think. They say they want to talk to you about—"
But Vimes was already clattering down the stairs, drawing his sword as he did so. The dwarfs were clustered nervously by the duty officer's desk. They had that opulence of metalwork, sleekness of beard and thickness of girth that marked them out as dwarfs who were doing very well for themselves, or who had been right up until now. Vimes appeared in front of them like a whirlwind of wrath. "You scum, you rat-sucking little worm-eaters, you heads-down little scurriers in the dark. What did you bring to my city? What were you thinking? Did you want the deep-downers here? Did you think about what Ham-Crusher said, all that bile and ancient lies? Or did you say, 'Well, I don't agree with him, of course, but he's got a point'? Did you say, 'Oh, he goes too far, but it's about time somebody said it'? And now, have you come here to wring your hands and say how deplorable it was nothing to do with you?" "Who were the dwarfs and the mobs, then? Aren't you community leaders? Were you leading them? And why are you here now, you ugly, snivelling grubbers? Is it possible, is it possible, that now, after that bastard's bodyguards try to kill my family, you're here to complain? Have I broken some code, trodden on some ancient toe? To hell with it. To hell with you." He could feel the words straining, fighting to get out, and the effort of restraining them filled his stomach with acid and made his temples throb. "Just one whine," he thought. "Just one pompous moan. Go on." "Well?" he demanded. The dwarfs had perceptibly moved backwards. Vimes wondered if they'd read his thoughts. They'd echoed in his brain loudly enough. A dwarf cleared his throat.
"Commander Vimes," he began.
"Your paws strong in the arm, aren't you?" Vimes demanded. "One half of Burley and strong in the arm, you make crossbows."
"Yes, Commander, and remove your weapons. All of them. All of you."
The room fell silent. Out of the corner of his eye, Vimes saw a couple of dwarf officers, who had at least been pretending to be engaged in paperwork, rising from their seats. He was being dangerously stupid, part of him knew, but right now he wanted to hurt a dwarf, and he wasn't allowed to do it with steel. Most of the battle stuff they wore was simply for clang in any case, but a dwarf would sooner drop his drawers than put aside his axe. And these were serious city dwarfs, with seats in the guilds and everything. Ye gods, he was going too far. He managed to grunt,
"All right, keep your battle axes. Leave everything else at the desk. You'll get a receipt."
For a moment, quite a long moment, he thought, No, he hoped they would refuse. But one of them, somewhere in the group, said,
"I think we must do this for the commander.
These are difficult times. We must learn to fit them." Vimes went up to his office, hearing the clinks and clangs behind him, and landed so violently in his chair that it rolled back against the wall. The receipt was a nasty touch. He was quite pleased with it. On his desk, on a little stand that Sybil had had made for it, was his official baton of office. It was, in fact, the same size as the ordinary copper's truncheon, but it was turned out of rosewood and silver instead of lignum vitae or oak. It still had plenty of weight, though, certainly enough to leave the words "Protector of the King's Peace" printed back to front on a dwarf skull. The dwarfs were ushered in, looking slightly less heavy. "Just one word," Vimes thought as the acid swirled. "One damn word. Go on. Just breathe wrong."
"Very well, what can I do for you?" he said. "I'm sure you know all of us," Paws began, trying to smile. "Probably. The dwarf next to you is Grabpot Thundergust, who has just launched the new Ladies' Secrets range of perfumes and cosmetics. My wife uses your stuff all the time."
Thundergust, in traditional chain mail, a three-horned helmet and an enormous axe strapped across his back, gave Vimes an embarrassed nod. Vimes's gaze moved on.
"And you are Setha Ironcrust, proprietor of the chain of bakeries of the same name, and you are surely Gimlet Gimlet, owner of two famous dwarf delicatessens and the newly opened Yo Rat in Attic B Street."
Vimes looked round the office, dwarf after dwarf, until he got back to the front row, and a dwarf of fairly modest dress by dwarf standards, who had been watching him intently. Vimes had a good memory for faces, and had seen this one recently, but couldn't place it. Perhaps it had been behind a well-flung half-brick.
"You, I don't think I know," he said. "Oh, we haven't exactly been introduced, Commander," said the dwarf cheerfully, "but I'm very interested in the theory of games."
"Or Mr. Shine's Thud Academy," Vimes thought. The dwarf's voice sounded like the one that had, he'd admit it, been of diplomatic help downstairs. He wore a simple, plain round helmet, a simple leather shirt with some basic mail on it, and his beard was clipped to something tidier than the general dwarfish gorse-bush effect. Compared to the other dwarfs, this one looked streamlined. Vimes couldn't even see an axe.
"Indeed," he said. "Well, in fact, I don't play 'em, so what's your name?"
"Bashful Bashfulson, Commander. Grag Bashfulson."
Quietly, Vimes picked up his truncheon and rolled it in his fingers.
"Not underground, then?" he said.
"Some of us move on, sir. Some of us think that darkness isn't a depth, it's a state of mind."
"That's nice of you," said Vimes.
"Oh, friendly and forward-looking are we now? Where were you yesterday? But now I've got all the aces. Those bastards murdered four city dwarfs. They broke into my home, tried to kill my wife, and now they've had it away on their toes. Wherever they've gone, they're going down, coming up." He put the truncheon back on its stand.
"As I said, what can I do for you, gentlemen?"
He got the sense that they were all turning, physically or mentally, to Bashfulson.
"I see," he thought. "It seems that what we have here is a dozen monkeys and one organ grinder, eh?"
"How can we help you, Commander?"
said the Grag. Vimes stared. "You could have stopped them, that's how you could have helped. Don't give me those somber faces. Maybe you didn't say yes, but you sure as hell didn't say no loud enough. I owe you not one damned thing. Don't come to me for your bloody absolution.
Right now, by going out onto the street, walking up to the biggest troll you can see and shaking him warmly by the hand, maybe," said Vimes. "Or just going out in the street. Quite frankly, I'm busy, gentlemen, and the middle of a horse race is not the time to be mending fences."
"They'll be heading for the mountains," said Bashfulson. "They'll steer clear of Uberwald and Lanka. They won't be sure of meeting friends there. That means going to the mountains via Clamedos. Lots of caves there."
Vimes shrugged.
"We can see you're annoyed, Mr. Vimes," said Strong in the Arm. "But we..."
"I've got two dead assassins in the morgue," said Vimes. "One of them died of poison. What do you know about that?" "And I'm Commander, Vimes, thank you."
"It's said they take a slow poison before they go on an important mission," said Bashfulson.
"No turning back, eh?" said Vimes. "Well, that's interesting.
But it's the living that concern me right now."
He stood up.
"I have to go and see a dwarf in the cells who does not want to talk to me.
"Ah, yes, that'll be Helm Clever," said Bashfulson. "He was born here, Commander, but went off to study in the mountains more than 3 months ago, against his parents' wishes. I'm sure he never intended anything like this. He was trying to find himself."
"Well, he can start looking in my cells," said Vimes crisply.
"May I be there when you question him?" said the Greg.
"Why?" snapped Vimes.
"Well, for one thing, it may prevent rumours that he was mistreated."
"Or start them," said Vimes.
"Who watches the watchman?" he asked himself.
"Me."
Bashfulson gave him a cool look.
"It could calm the situation, sir."
"I don't habitually beat up prisoners, if that's what you're suggesting," said Vimes.
"And I am sure you would not wish to do so tonight."
Vimes opened his mouth to shout the Greg out of the building, and stopped, because the cheeky little sod had got its right slap-bang on the money. Vimes had been on the edge since leaving the house. He'd felt a tingling across his skin, and a tightness in his gut, and a sharp, nasty little headache. Someone was going to pay for all this, and it didn't need to be a screwed-up bit-player like Helm Clever. And he was not certain at all, what he'd do if the prisoner gave him any lip, or tried to be smart. Beating people up in little rooms, he knew where that led. And if you did it for a good reason, you'd do it for a bad one. You couldn't say, "We're the good guys," and do bad guy things. Sometimes the watching watchman could use an extra pair of eyes. Justice has to be seen to be done, so he'd see it done up good and proper.
"Gentlemen," he said, keeping his eye on the Greg, but talking to the room at large. "I know all of you, and you all know me. You're all respected dwarfs with a stake in this city. I want you to vouch for Mr. Bashfulson, because I've never met him before in my life. Come on, Gimli, I've known you for years. What do you say?"
"They killed my son," said Ironcrust.
A knife dropped into Vimes's head. It slipped down his windpipe, sliced his heart, cut through his stomach, and disappeared. Where the rage had been, there was a chill.
"I'm sorry, Commander," said Bashfulson quietly. "It's true. I don't think Gunder Ironcrust was interested in the politics, you understand. He just took a job at the mine because he wants to feel like a real dwarf and work with a shovel for a few days."
"They left him to the mud," said Ironcrust, in a voice that was eerily without emotion. "Any help you need, we will give. Any help. But when you find them, kill them all."
Vimes could think of nothing more to say than, "I will catch them." He didn't say, "Kill them, no, not if they surrender, not if they don't come at me armed. I know where that leads."
"Then we will leave and let you get about your business," said Strong in the Arm. "Greg Bashfulson is known to us indeed. A little modern, perhaps, a little young, not the kind of Greg we grew up with, but yes, we'd vouch for him. Good night, Commander."
Vimes stared at his desk as they filed out. When he looked up, the Greg was still there, with a patient little smile.
"He don't look like a Greg. He looked like just another dwarf," said Vimes.
"Why have I heard of you?"
"Because you are a policeman, perhaps," said Bashfulson meekly.
"Okay, I take the point. But you're not a deep downer."
Bashfulson shrugged.
"I can think deep thoughts. I was born here, Commander, just like Helm Clever. I don't believe I need a mountain over my head in order to be a dwarf."
Vimes nodded. A local lad, not some mountain greybeard. Got a quick brain, too. No wonder the leaders like him.
"All right, Mr. Bashfulson, you can tag along," he said. "But it's on two conditions, okay? Condition one, you've got 5 minutes to lay your hands on a thud set. I think you can do that?"
"I think I can, too," said the dwarf, smiling faintly. "And the other condition?"
"How long will it take you to teach me to play?" said Vimes.
You've never played it at all."
"No. A certain troll showed me the game a little while ago, but I've never played games since I grew up. I used to be good at tiddly-rats."
A famous Ankh-Morpork gutter sport, second only to dead-rat conkers. Turd races in the gutter appear to have died out, despite an attempt to make them upmarket with the name Poo-Sticks.
"I used to be good at tiddly-racks when I was nipper, though."
"Well, a few hours should be..." Bashfulson began.
"We don't have time," said Vimes. "You've got 10 minutes.
The drinking had started in the bucket in Gleam Street. This was the Coppers' pub. Mr. Cheese, the owner, understood about coppers. They liked to drink somewhere where they wouldn't see anything that reminded them they were a copper. Fun was not encouraged. It was Tawny who suggested that they moved to Thank Gods It's Open. Angua wasn't really in the mood, but she hadn't the heart to say no.
The plain fact was that while Tawny had a body that every other woman should hate her for, she compounded the insult by actually being very likable. This was because she had the self-esteem of a caterpillar, and, as you found out in any kind of conversation with her, about the same amount of brain. Perhaps it all balanced out. Perhaps some kindly god had said to her, "Sorry, kid, you're going to be thicker than a yard of lard, but the good news is that's not going to matter." And she had a stomach made of iron, too. Angua found herself wondering how many hopeful men had died trying to drink her under the table. Alcohol didn't seem to go to her head at all. Maybe it couldn't find it. But she was pleasant, easy-going company, if you avoided allusion, irony, sarcasm, repartee, satire, and words longer than chicken. Angua was tetchy because she was dying for a beer, but the young man behind the bar thought that a pint of Winkles was the name of a cocktail. Given the drinks on offer, perhaps this was not surprising. "What," said Angua, reading the menu, "is a screaming orgasm?" "Ah," said Sully, "looks like we got to you just in time, girl." "No," sighed Angua, as the others laughed. That was such a vampire response. "I mean, what's it made of?"
"Al Monte, Walulu, Bearhuggers Whiskey, Cream and Vodka," said Tawny,
who knew the recipe for every cocktail ever made.
"And how does it work?"
said Cheery, craning to see over the top of the bar. Sally ordered four and turned back to Tawny.
"So, you and Nobby Nobs, eh?" she said. "How about that?"
Three sets of ears flared. The other thing you got used to in the presence of Tawny was silence. Everywhere she went, went quiet. Oh, and the stairs, the silent stairs. And sometimes, in the shadows, a sigh. There were goddesses who'd killed to look like Tawny.
"He's nice," said Tawny. "He makes me laugh, and he keeps his hands to himself."
Three faces locked in expressions of concentrated thought. This was Nobby they were talking about. There were so many questions they were not going to ask.
"Has he shown you the tricks he can do with his spots?" Angua said. "Yes, I thought I'd whittle myself. He's so funny."
Angua stared into a drink. Cheery coughed. Sally studied the menu.
"And he's very dependable," said Tawny.
And, as if dimly aware that this was still not sufficient, she added sadly,
"If you must know, he's the first boy who's ever asked me out."
Sally and Angua breathed out together. Light dawned.
Ah, that was the problem. And this one's a bad case.
"I mean, my hair's all over the place. My legs are too long, and I know my bosom is far too..."
Tawny went on, but Sally had raised a quieting hand.
"First point, Tawny. My real name's Betty,"
said Tawny, blowing a nose so exquisite that the greatest sculptor in the world would have wept to carve it. It went blort.
"First point, then, Betty,"
Sally managed, struggling to use the name,
"is that no woman under 45.
50, Angua corrected.
"Right, 50. No woman under 50 uses the word bosom to name anything connected to her. You just don't do it."
"I didn't know that." Tawny sniffed. "It's a fact," said Angua. And oh dear, how to begin to explain the jerk syndrome? To someone like Tawny, on whom the name Betty stuck like rocks to a ceiling. This wasn't just a case of the jerk syndrome. This was it, the quintessential, classic, pure, platonic example, which should be stuffed and mounted and preserved as a teaching aid for students in the centuries to come. And she was happy with Nobby. "What I've got to tell you now is," she began and faded in the face of the task, "is, look, shall we have another drink? What's the next cocktail on the menu?"
Cheery peered at it. "Pink, bigger, wobbly," she announced.
"Classy, we'll have four."